History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned over the years is that they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week, the college football season kicks off, and that made me think of some of the veterans we've had on this show who had their college football careers interrupted by World War II. If you compare the game in 2021 with college football 80 years ago, the points of differentiation are plentiful. And the reality is many of America's best college football players gave their lives during World War II. Others were wounded, became prisoners, or experienced other life-altering turns. I went back through all the different college footballers we've interviewed over the years on Hometown Heroes, and I picked out three of them that I think you're really going to enjoy hearing from today. We'll start out with a guy who played in the same backfield at the University of Nevada with Hall of Famer Marion Motley, went on to fly P-51s in Europe, and spent 5 months as a prisoner of war before a long post-war career as a high school football coach and math teacher in Bakersfield, California. Jordan Eliadis, or Turk as he was known for most of his life, grew up in McGill, Nevada, and we pick up his story when he was wearing that Nevada Wolfpack jersey in December 1941.
When we were playing, I don't remember what game it was. It was near the end of our schedule at university. We had the situation where the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. A number of guys in the fraternity house, they went in the service right away. Some of the older guys, I don't know why. But anyway, when we declared war on Germany, I knew I was going to have to go. We had our next to the last football game, and after the football game, there was a couple of other guys, and we went to Sacramento to enroll. I thought flying sounded pretty good, so that's where we signed up.
Had you ever flown before?
No, never flown before. It was all new. We took a test. I think there were four of us. Two of them didn't make it on the exam. The next day we went and had a physical. I have never had a physical like that before. What they ask you to do and some of the things, which was a normal physical check, you know, all that. And one of the guys flunked out. I was the only guy that made it. When I went back, he said to me, "Well, you're in school. Don't worry about it. They're not going to call you for a long time or whatever." Anyway, it was in latter part of November when my dad got killed. And I was in school at the university, got home. Of course, I was very close with my high school coach. You know, I was the quarterback on the high school football team. But I never carried the ball. Occasionally, I would receive a pass. You were a blocking back. That's what you were on, that single wing. Is what you were. But when I got to University of Nevada, I want to tell you, I remember the first day we were dressing and Marion Motley was there. Oh, my gosh. I can't explain to you what a body. My God, he had to be 6 foot, but man, he was just like poured out that way. I want to tell you something. You'll think it's crazy. When our fullback, who was our blocking back, they had to do the blocking. You know who had to do the blocking? I had the block for those people. We played an army team here in town. I mean, there. And one of the guys I recognized, the name, because in the fraternity, it shows me tackling him. Of course, I didn't know who he was. When I got back here in Bakersfield, he was the head coach at Garces High School.
How about that?
I remember we talked about it and so on. It's all they could talk about was Marion Motley and so on.
Well, and maybe some younger listeners don't know the name Marion Motley, but this is a Pro Football Hall of Famer, one of the greatest athletes of the 1940s. And here he is, your teammate at the University of Nevada. And you were blocking for him?
When we played the Army team, I blocked for him that day. I remember the first time I went out to block that in, he must have hit me and knocked me after that. You know, most of those guys were all college guys. that were in the service. They had some top-notch people.
So that's what you did while you continued at the University of Nevada until you got called to active duty? You
right.
kept playing?
I remember the first mission I was into Germany. I was only 21 years old. Once we got into German territory, I remember saying to myself, there's no friends down there.
And what were your typical missions like? Are you guys flying low and strafing?
There's a place called the Zuider Zee. Mm-hmm. And we would meet the bombers basically at that point. How do you know which group you're, let's say, covering and not mix it up with some other? If you look on a B-17 and you look at the tail will tell you the group. Mm-hmm. It might be a square. It might be a diamond. It might be a letter. It might be something. The letters for a 55th fighter group was Y something. If you saw a 51 that had the number Y something, it was from the 55th fighter group. Every group had a letter designation.
So most of your missions were escort missions for the bombers.
Oh, yeah, practically everything. But we did a lot of strafing. Once we got the bombers back to friendly territory, depending on our leader, we went back and started strafing fields. We did a lot of strafing. You strafe an airfield, but the way we strafed it, we'd make a pass and then get the hell out of there. You know what I mean? On this day, we were supposed to strafe on the Rhine, but it was really heavy cover. I mean, you couldn't see the ground. What would happen? We'd fly around, we'd find a hole, we'd dive down through the hole, and we did this eventually enough times, and we got down below the level. We were around 600 feet or thereabouts. The guy that was leading us says, okay, get in flight formation, we're going home. I can remember distinctly to this day that when he said we were in friendly territory, let's go home, I thought, I remember Holland and a few of those places which were very close to where he was talking about. And I remember this Tudor 5-2, you sure we're in friendly territory? Yes. It wasn't maybe 2 or 3 minutes later, I get this jut. And I thought, what the hell's wrong? And pretty soon, I could see the tracers coming. We ended up going right over a flak battery. There were two other guys that went down. I didn't know what happened to them. They thought I got killed. They didn't know. Because once that happened, the planes just started scattering. Right away, when I got hit, and it started trying to go and try to. So I said, I got to get out of this plane. I can't. There's no way I can survive if I have to go into these dikes. There's no level ground around here. I got up to as much as I could to 1,000 feet, and I bailed out. And when I hit the ground, the parachute couldn't have been open very long, because the moment I hit the ground, those knees came clear up beyond my face. And I think I was out of it for a while. It was windy. Parachute was being drugged me, and I ended up in a ditch with water. And the moment I hit the water, I came to. But when I came to, I looked up on a bank, and here's a Sherman soldier pointing his gun at me, wanted me to get my hands up in the air. And that was it.
So because you had to bail out so low, the force with which you hit the ground sent your knees into your head and knocked you out.
It really, I don't remember being drugged at all. The only thing I remember is the moment I hit that water, I came to. So I probably might have been out a little bit. I don't know.
And you were probably not too far from getting killed.
Well, there's a possibility.
I mean, you're probably a few seconds here or there, or
yeah.
The timing of it.
I don't know. It could have been very easily. I am going to tell you something. Gus Leslie was on a mission prior to when I went down. I remember when we get back, we talk about our mission, ask questions, and so on. But Gus wasn't in the same group that I was with. He was with a different one. The 343rd would go out, but you'd have 4 or 5 different flights in that particular one. I asked, where's Gus Leslie? Hey, where's Gus Leslie? No one knew. When I got shot down, the German soldier got me up in the air. They took me out into the middle of the, it was just an open area. I remember it was a little bit of rain. The head guy comes out. There's a couple of them standing there, and he's talking. I know that if I was in Japan, I wouldn't be here. That guy could have taken out a gun, bang. No one knew what happened to me. When I finally, eventually, when I tell you, when I got back to the group, talking to the guys and so on, they didn't know. They thought I had got killed and so on. Well, anyway, they put two soldiers with me, and eventually they're going to take me to an interrogation camp. And in interrogation, you're told, you don't have to give them anything but name, rank, and serial number. Then he starts asking you about other things. Where'd you go to school? All this stuff and so on. The guy that interrogated me, he knew so much more about the 8th Air Force than I'll ever know. But before I went to see the interrogator, the guy takes me out of this room. You're in a single room, and I'm walking. And as I'm walking, a door open on my right opens up. You know who it was? Gus Leslie.
What are the odds?
There are no odds. I don't know how you could. As I was walking right there, the door opened, and I said, Gus. And then I thought, God, that's terrible. You better not say anything. But he got away. I mean, he went down. He got shot down, and he was free for several days. And then looking for food and stuff, they finally got him. And then eventually they put him in the interrogation area. But when I stop and think, that day when I was walking, he was had a hold of me, taking me to the interrogator. Gus Leslie comes up. Then it wasn't very long after that they got rid of us and sent us to Stalag 1. We went by train.
Well, and you know, when you say you yell out his name and then you wish you hadn't, because they can use you against him and vice versa and try to get two to talk about each other.
Yeah.
But I imagine just seeing his face had to be at the time really significant for some hope to know that, hey, there's somebody I know that's going through this with me.
Yeah, they picked him up. I can say one thing. I had two German soldiers with me all the time. I went by train a number of times. This one particular time, they had an air raid. I had to get off the train and go into a nearby bunker. When I was down there, the whole place was loaded with German soldiers with head wounds. Everything up here and so on. There was a woman come over, and she's talking from about there to you, looking at her. And I don't want to even look at her. I'm trying to look away from her. And she must have called me every name under the sun, talking in German. You know, when I think about that, they could have killed me right there. Nobody would have known anything like that. Just like when I bailed out and the head guy came out and they were talking, what they were talking about, to have a couple of guys and go with me and take me to an interrogation place. But I didn't know that at the time.
And they needed those guys to protect you because the civilians might do something else with you.
They were with me all the time. That's what helped me the time that I'm telling you about. When we got down there, and then, of course, the fact that I was a flyer and, you know, you're the enemy and that type of thing. And I was really glad because they stood one on each side of me when this gal was talking. And it didn't take long when it was over with. Boy, they got me out of there and so on. So from that standpoint, I was lucky that they were with me.
And you're a 21-year-old kid, and you don't know how long this war is going to go. You don't know what it is like to be a prisoner. But now you end up in this prison camp. Were you afraid? Did you have any expectation of what was going to happen?
No, I don't think so. I don't even remember being afraid of a situation. There were just a bunch of other people that were there. No one ever mentioned that there was something, they had done something that was, you know, beat somebody or something like that. It was unbelievable. It was just, I can't say that like I was on vacation somewhere. That's about what it was. But, you know, we moved around in the compound. Some people set up a volleyball deal. They played volleyball. I played softball. We were allowed to pick a softball team from our compound. We went to the South compound and played the British in a softball game. And then I come to find out that there was a couple of guys in there from McGill, Nevada.
Wow.
They were on bombers and so on. We were in compound 3. They were in compound 1 or 2. I don't remember which one. But I had a chance to go and visit with them. If you signed up and you wanted to go visit, you could.
Well, speaking of McGill, what about your mom? Did she have any idea what had happened to you? Did she know where you were?
When she first heard, all she got was missing in action. Then, I don't remember whether it was several weeks or a month or so on, the Red Cross was giving names of people that were in prison. Then somebody there had contacted my mom that I was in prison camp. And that's when the first time that they knew I hadn't been killed, that I was in prison camp. They allowed us to write letters. I remember I wrote my parents, several times. And I remember writing Coach Bledsoe several times. And I remember when I got home, I remember Bledsoe gave me all that. He says, "You want to see what you wrote?" And so on. I don't know.
Did you ever have days in that camp? Because you're there until the end of April 1945. I mean, we're talking 5 months as a prisoner. Did you ever have days where you weren't sure if you were ever going to experience freedom again?
No. We had a makeshift radio that got news from London every night. We knew where Patton was. We knew where the British were. We knew that the Russians were coming from the opposite end. So it was just a matter of waiting until they got there. The situation got so bad in town. German people came from the town, came to the prison, and asked for protection from the Russians.
Right. I have to imagine that there was a different atmosphere around the camp
those
few days.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. You know, the Americans were up there. We could leave the camp. They said, maybe it'd be better if you just stay in camp. It'd be, you know, you have no problem. I remember Gus and I and some others, we got out and walked around. What I was hoping, I could find some guy who was fishing so I could borrow his pole. I wanted to fish and so on. I loved to fish and so on.
Did you lose any weight while you were there?
Yeah, lost weight. That's the only thing, I lost some weight.
How much?
Probably in the neighborhood of 15, 18 pounds, probably.
Not bad compared to some others, I've heard.
I know some people, it was really a problem. I don't know why some people couldn't handle the food. I don't know why. I really loved the bread. I thought it was great. It was different.
With sawdust baked into it and all that?
Well, there's no doubt about it. When you cut a slice and you look at it, you have a feeling that there's some ingredients in there that you're not quite sure of.
But it kept you alive.
Oh, yeah. And like you say, you had straw mattresses. You hope some days where you get a sunny day where you could take it outside and shake it a little bit. Because once you slept in a certain position on that straw mattress, you had to get back in that same position to sleep. In other words, you can't sleep in a different part of that. I mean, you slept on your side, then you just fit into that part of the mattress and so on. But it was a prison camp.
So the camp's liberated, but you guys are still there. And I'm sure there's a little bit of, well, what's going to happen next? And then they fly some bombers in to pick
they
you up?
They flew B-17s. It wasn't right away. It was a couple of weeks. Supposedly, can you imagine this? We had to get permission from the Russians to fly bombers in here. That's what they were telling us. But B-17s, then I don't remember how many we put on there, but I remember I was right up in front. We flew to Lucky Strike, which was in France, and then it was there that Leslie and I, we went somewhere and got on an airplane, flew back to the base, and went back to our outfit and visited with guys, you know, that we knew and everything else.
Did some of those guys still think you were dead?
Yeah, well, they didn't know that we were in prison. When I got back, there were several of the planes got shot down, and they thought I got killed. They didn't have any idea. You know, I have a feeling that what's happened, after I had communicated with the head guy and said, "Are you sure we are in friendly territory?" I have a feeling that he might have called, somebody might have called me. And I didn't answer. That's probably what happened.
So that would explain why they thought you were gone.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
But when they reported it to my mother, there's all they said, missing in action. That's all they said.
So when you actually got back to the States and got to go see your mother again,
yeah,
what was that like?
Well, Mom was beside herself. You know, when you're young and you're 21 years old, I think a lot of times you think you're indestructible, you know. Once I got over there and we were flying those missions and we were losing people. Every time we went on a mission and we did strafing and things like that, we were losing two or three people every day, you know. You know, I think back on, you know, being over there, the chances of getting killed, who knows?
It's time for our first break, but we have two more World War II era college football players for you to hear from, including one who played after losing a finger in the Marines. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode celebrating the kickoff of college football season with the stories of three men who had their college careers interrupted by World War II. College football is all about rivalries, and the one that's been contested the most is Harvard versus Yale. We've had World War II vets who played in that game on this show, but right now we're going to hear from one who played in college football's fourth most played rivalry, going back to 1895. The Black Hills Brawl pits the Hard Rockers of South Dakota School of Mines and Technology against the Yellow Jackets of Black Hills State University in Spearfish, South Dakota. Seth Irving played in the Black Hills Brawl for the Yellow Jackets in 1940 and 1941. He grew up in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, on the Oglala Lakota Reservation. But after that 1941 season at Black Hills State and the ensuing Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Seth enlisted in the Navy. He served on the destroyer USS Newcomb in the Pacific and nearly lost his life in a kamikaze attack off of Okinawa on April 6, 1945.
Now, we went to Okinawa about 3-4 days and bombarded, and then the Marines came and Army came and landed. Then we went on picket duty, they call it. All the destroyers were lined up around, kind of half circle around the island, and we were on the northernmost part of that circle. April 6, 1945, approximately 4:35 o'clock, we got a report that over 500 kamikaze planes were leaving Japan.
And you still weren't scared?
No, we got prepared to fight.
Holy moly.
Yeah. And then, you know, we had a lot of aircraft carriers around. They released their, and they shot down approximately half of them, or a little over a half. Mm-hmm. So there was only about 200 or something got through into the ship area. And that's when we got into it.
So you're on your 40 millimeter mount.
I was on my 40 millimeter mount, but I wasn't firing on anybody, because my ship must have been going east. The planes came from the north. Mm-hmm. And so the port side man, he was firing on them, but we were at a standstill because there was nothing coming past.
So you're just sitting there waiting to get something to shoot at.
Sitting there waiting for somebody to tell us there's a plane here or there. But the first kamikaze that broke through, I had a rangefinder. He was on the phone with the control, who told him where the planes were, and he would set the range on that gun sight, and he's the one that told me, he said, hit the deck, Seth, there's the plane coming. So I don't know how I did it. I unhooked, and I didn't hit the deck. By that time, it blew me into the water.
You didn't hit the deck because the plane hit your ship before you had a chance to hit the deck.
Yes. All I could see was planes coming. That's all I remember anyway. Mm-hmm. I must have lost it, but I wound up in the water.
So the impact of this kamikaze on your ship Blew you right into the water.
Yeah.
Means the ship hit, the plane hit pretty close to where you were.
Yeah, it hit about the middle of the stack. And the stack that I was on threw me and bent over. And I guess that's what happened to me. But that rangefinder didn't make it.
A lot of guys didn't make it.
Yeah. No, I had a 10-man gun crew. I was the only survivor on that gun crew. The other gun crew, there was only one survivor off of that one. I was firing at it. And then after I got into the water, the propeller must have missed me by 2-3 feet.
So you're in the water, you're conscious, you're burnt, well, and this propeller is flying right at you? The propeller from the plane, or you're talking about?
Our propeller.
Your ship. You almost got caught in the screws of the destroyer.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I must have been underwater because I could hear it just mumble. And I came up, and that screw, you know, was pushing the water, and it just pushed me out of the way.
Wow.
It pushed me about 100 feet or more away from the ship.
I'm sure you're still pretty stunned and dazed, but how much pain were you in?
I don't remember being in any pain. All I know is that when I was strapped in, I had a steel helmet on, I had a capot jacket on, and all of my clothes were gone. I was bare.
You were naked in the water?
Yeah. I didn't have no shoes. I was burned from my hair was all burned off to about my knee, all on the front side, you know.
So the explosion blew all your clothes off, your helmet off, burnt all your hair off, and burnt you from head to knee.
Yeah.
But you weren't in pain.
I don't feel pain. I don't know why. I just didn't feel pain.
What went through your mind when you realized what kind of condition you were in?
Survival, I guess. That's when survival takes over. I was in that water from about 4:30 until about 10 o'clock at night. Now, that was the scariest part because you start getting scared, you know.
Well, yeah.
Because of the sharks, etc. I was really scared. And during that period, from about 4:30, 5 o'clock, there was a burnt life raft came floating by, and I jumped onto it. I thought I was going to get saved, but there was nothing on there. It was just burnt. And I was riding it along like that in the ship and in maybe 2-3 hours, and it was getting dark, and I saw a silhouette of a destroyer sitting there, and I noticed that I was going to miss it by floating, you know.
Yeah, you're floating on this raft, and it's going to take you away from the destroyer.
Yeah. So I abandoned the raft. I figured even though that ship probably couldn't pick me up because they're still under attack, you know.
Yeah, it's not like you can hit the timeout button, come pick me up. They're still fighting each other.
Yeah, and so I was just about ready to get to that ship, and it took off. Of course, on that water, it just pushed me back out of the way, and there I was with nothing, just swimming by myself. I didn't have nothing on me.
So you're naked, you're burnt, you've already been in the water for 3 hours, and now your chance at survival just
vanished.
Went away from you.
Yeah.
Did you think you were going to die in that moment?
Yes, I did. I figured I don't think I could make it till morning.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you hear stories about ships and survivors on life rafts for 4 or 5 days, some weeks, some. But I didn't think I was going to make it. Then it was pitch dark, and then I was floating, and it was dark, and all of a sudden I saw a flicker of light, just barely saw it. I started screaming, you know. That light came right up to me, and they picked me up around 10 o'clock at night. And, of course, they gave me morphine and put me out within a half an hour, within 15 minutes while I was aboard that ship. I got up by the ship, and guys came down on a
rope ladder?
Yeah.
To get you?
To get me. And they grabbed my hand like that, and that slipped, fell back into the water.
Did they just pull the skin off your arms?
Yeah.
Oh, ouch.
I was burned, you know. I didn't realize it either.
They didn't realize it either?
No, they didn't know it, you know. The next group came down, they raised me up out of there.
That had to be painful. Or you were still kind of numb or in shock. Huh?
I must have been in shock because I don't even remember pain. All I remember, I was saved. I know that and within 15 minutes, I was treated, you know. Whatever they did was right. The next morning, that ship transferred me over to a transport that was transporting troops.
Uh-huh.
Was converted to a hospital ship,
mm-hmm.
and I was transferred to it.
You mentioned when you first found yourself in the water and took stock of the situation that you were concerned about sharks, about the enemy that was still firing away.
Yeah.
Did you see any sharks during those 6 hours?
Nope.
Good thing.
No. And another strange thing is I didn't see another body.
Nothing.
Nothing. I don't know if that propeller caught me alone and sent me out that way.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I looked and looked and looked because I was wanting to be picked up right away, you know.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. But I didn't see a soul. I was out there for them 6 hours alone.
6 hours?
Yeah.
How long did it feel like?
Lifetime, really. Oh, howdy.
I've talked to some guys who've been in similar situations in the water for a long time. And some guys will describe doing things to keep their mind occupied or thinking through different scenarios. Or some guys would say a prayer. They'd frantically, try to get someone else's attention. What did you do? How did you pass that time?
I don't remember.
I mean, mentally, what was going through your mind? Were you saying a prayer? Were you saying, I'm going to make it? I know I can? I mean, how did you keep going? Where did you find that hope and that persistence to power through?
All I know is I had to survive, you know.
Yeah.
And I did whatever I could. I never saw a shark, and I never saw another human being in there. That burnt wrap was the only thing that I saw, and I should have stuck to it, but I didn't.
Well, what do you think would have happened to you if that raft didn't float by?
I probably would have died. I probably would have let myself die, for I was never a good swimmer, but I stayed afloat.
And that 3 hours made a big difference, I'm sure, to have that raft.
Yeah.
Another question that comes to mind, sorry for all my crazy questions, but you said something when that kamikaze hit, and again, you got the word that something was coming, and just before it hits, you unbuckle. If you did not unstrap yourself from that position, what do you think would have happened?
I would have been drowned. Because I think that, although that guy told me to unbuckle, and I did, and he didn't, because he didn't survive.
He probably didn't have time.
He must have not unbuckled.
Yeah.
And went down with the...
So the whole gun mount went into the water.
Yeah.
So you would have been trapped, if not killed by the impact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or else drowned.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how far down it went. But I know I didn't go very far in because I came up and I just threw some salt water out. But it wasn't that much. So I must have just went in and out, you know.
And just the fact that of your 10-man crew, you were the only one to survive and that the other gun crew had the same ratio. I mean, that in itself says you beat some pretty significant odds to survive.
Boy, hardly we did. Well.
How do you explain it?
I have no answer to that because 84 of my shipmates died that evening amidships. All those torpedo men, they were right in that, and that stack was above a engine room.
Yeah.
And it blew. That was engine room number 2. That blew the same time I got it. And all those guys didn't survive. There were some survivors. Of course, the first plane got me.
Yeah.
But there was 4 other planes hit that ship.
5 kamikazes on 1 destroyer.
Yes.
But it didn't sink.
It didn't sink.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
1 well-placed kamikaze was plenty to sink a destroyer, if not a bigger ship, at other places in the war.
Right. Now, those destroyers were really built strong.
Well, so that ended the war for you, obviously.
Yes.
How long did it take you to recover from all this, and what was that period like?
You know, I was all bandaged up completely, so I didn't see daylight after I got on board that ship. My eyes must have been burnt bad.
You could see, but all the flesh around your eyes
was
burnt.
I didn't see anything.
In the water, did you see
anything?
No. In the water, you saw the light coming to you and all that.
In the water, I saw it after they treated me.
Right.
And they put stuff on me, and they must have put bandage that thick on me. I don't know what they did.
They bandaged you from your head all the way down.
All the way down. I was bandaged all the way down. I was burned all the way down. And so I didn't see daylight until I got released from the hospital at the Guam Burn Unit. That must have been 30 days later.
Wow.
So I was without sight. I didn't see anything. But apparently I could see, you know.
But you were just covered up.
I was just covered up.
Well, that's a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
30 days with no one to look at.
Yeah.
You can hear people. You can't see them. What did you think about for 30 days? Did you think I'm going to go back home and go marry a girl from my reservation? Or what were you thinking about?
I was just thinking about getting well.
Yeah.
I didn't think about anything else, you know. And I wasn't the only one. There was a 1,000 burn victims at that Guam burn unit.
Seth Irving went on to a long career as a junior college administrator. If you want to see what he looked like as a Black Hills State Yellow Jacket football player, head over to hometownheroesradio.com. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, one more college football player who risked his life for our country in World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Does this ever happen to you? You hear a promotion for a blood drive, but you can't donate because you did so too recently? Trust me, I know the feeling, which is why I'm giving you advance notice. Circle Thursday, August 26th on your calendar for the Central Valley Trailer Repair Blood Drive. It's a pint for a pint. Show up between 1:30 and 5:30, donate your life-saving blood, and you'll receive a coupon good for a free pint of Baskin-Robbins ice cream. Whichever flavor you prefer, I'm a little partial to peach or strawberry myself, but it's going to taste that much better in our triple-digit temperatures, and you're going to feel even better for helping to save lives. It really is that simple. That's Thursday, August 26th at Central Valley Trailer Repair. The address is 2974 Southeast Avenue in Fresno. And if that date doesn't work, the Central California Blood Center is still in need, so you can make other arrangements at donateblood.org. Thanks in advance for your life-saving gift, and thanks to Central Valley Trailer Repair for their support.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode as America kicks off another season of college football. We're listening to the memories of three college football players who served in World War II. At hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to the complete original interviews with Turk Eliadis, who played for the University of Nevada, Seth Irving from Black Hills State, and now we get to hear from a guy who played for the Big Green of Dartmouth after being wounded as a World War II Marine. Before the war, Francis O'Brien was on the swim team at St. Joseph's College in Philadelphia. He joined the Marines right after Pearl Harbor, eventually deploying with the 4th Marine Division.
Going to the Marshall Islands at a place called Kwajalein, which was the largest island-enclosed portion of the lagoon in the Pacific Ocean. One end of the lagoon was Kwajalein. At the other end of the island was a place called Roy and Namur. And it was R-O-I for Roy and Namur, N-A-M-U-R. And we were going to land on the moor. And our lieutenant, said, you know, tomorrow we're going to land on the moor. There are about 2,500 Japanese there. We're going to land with about 2,500 men. And in 24 hours, it is either ours or we're all dead. And that was the pep talk.
That's encouraging, isn't it?
Very encouraging. So we're supposed to land by LVTs, which are landing vehicle tractor. They had problems before with Tarawa, where the landing boats got hung up on a reef. The tide had changed and whatever else had happened, and they couldn't get in. The men had to wade ashore about a couple hundred yards offshore, had to wade to get on the island.
And a lot of them didn't get on the island. They got mowed down trying to get there.
A lot didn't get there, and so now we're going to bypass that action. We're going to go in the back way into the lagoon, and we'll have aerial guys from the 25th Marines going. We were the 24th. From the 25th Marines going to set up artillery on these little islets to kind of support us as we came in the back way. Well, you're aboard the USTs, and we had to put camouflage paint on and all that business, and we did. Then we got aboard the LVTs. Now we were supposed to leave at 10 o'clock. But it takes time to get LVTs off. Then once they're lined up, then the commanders go, and you go towards the island. That way, everybody is on the island pretty much at the same time. So we got on the island, and we had a young guy from Champaign, Illinois, who was bet by some hot shot in his class that he could get in the Marine Corps, and Frank couldn't. Frank was so naive, he said, I bet him. He said, I got in the Marine Corps, and he didn't, plus the fact I didn't get the $50. And that's the kind of gullibility. I mean, and a super smart kid. I think they claim he had the highest IQ in the division. But anyway, we land. Someone said, where's Frank? I said, I don't know. He's probably behind somewhere. I said, I'll go back and check. And I went back to check. And Frank was in a hole in his helmet. He was dead. And there he was sitting there. He's the first casualty that I saw. And, you know, that leaves the mark on you that, well, you know, when someone says, sniper, be awake, be alert, there's probably somebody who, you know, doing something. So we went through the moor. We got down through a clearing, and I was a bazooka man and firing these rockets. I had never fired a rocket before because you don't expend the ammunition and all that. You go through the dry runs. So the officer said there was a house and a spotlight, a searchlight, and he said, see if you can hit the house. You know, see if you can. So I aimed and hit the house and blew it up. And when that happens, this is different now than being trained. Now see what you can do when you do it. That kind of gives you some enthusiasm. But now you become almost like a showboat. Boy, I'm glad I can hit that house. And then he said, there was a Japanese sitting up on top of a revetment. He said, O'Brien, you hit the Japanese and I'll kiss your eyes. And I thought that was an interesting challenge. So I aimed. And what happens with the Zuka tube, it's just a pipe. As it gets hot from the propellant in the rocket, you're almost aiming at the ground because it'll take off on you. I was aiming at the ground and apparently hit the Japanese, and he's on my back, banging on my shoulder, just like he scored a touchdown. Hooray, hooray, on his back. Oh, jeez. So now we thought we were going to take over the island. So Al Prusik, the officer, and Norman Savage, just a guy like I was, the three of us take off to the revetment. And as we got there, our machine gunners opened fire on the revetment. At the same time, the Japanese in the revetment opened fire. So now we're on our back watching all these tracer bullets go by, because between each tracer there's probably three or four regular bullets. And we watched that for about a half an hour. It was thrilling. It was neat. It was something we hadn't done before. Now they cease firing. So I got up first, and I led the bunch out, and I'm running down. And I kind of made a half turn to my left. And as I did, I felt like I got hit in the epiplexis of your body. And I kind of lost my breath. I kept running, got down into the hole, and my little finger on my left hand was just hanging off, just like a chicken wing had been broken. It wasn't bleeding, it wasn't hurting, but it looked kind of strange. Prusik, the officer, came in, and I said, I've been hit. He said, you haven't been. I said, look at that finger. Hey, damn if you haven't. So for the first time, I had seen a first aid packet open up. And all the first aid packet was a piece of Kotex about 4 or 5 inches long with about 72 yards of cotton bandage. And miserable. You try putting that on a finger that's hanging out, and it doesn't do much. Now, I just casually put my hand up under my dungaree jacket, and man, it was a warm hole. And I thought, wow, what's that? And at that time, it's amazing. I couldn't speak. I couldn't talk. And Prusik wanted to give me some water. And I remember an old movie where Edward G. Robinson, I think it was, got raked by a machine gun. He had taken a drink of water, and he was trying to plug up the holes with his fingers as the water was coming out. And I said, I don't want water. You know, let me alone.
How much pain were you in?
It's interesting. I had no pain. Huh. I had no pain. They sent some guys up as stretcher bearers. And these were usually band men or cooks or something. And they came up. They didn't have a stretcher, so we had to improvise a stretcher. Well, then they couldn't lift me.
You were one of the bigger guys, huh?
So they couldn't lift me, so they dragged me through all these holes over to the beach. And again, honestly, nothing hurt.
Were you scared?
I wasn't bleeding, and I was still conscious. I knew what was going on. And we got down to the evacuation center. I remember the guy saying, where's the hospital ship? Well, there were about 9 transports out there. It's out there. We went out, we'd bump into a ship, and just the hospital ship says, no, try T-boats over. And we kept going. Finally, we got to a hospital ship. They lowered this thing down and hooked up my stretcher and picked me up and put me aboard the ship. And the first thing they did was take your valuables. And I think I had a New Testament and something else in the pocket. And they put that on my chest. Well, then they took all my clothes off and put my valuables on my chest. Took me to the mess room where the cooks had been and all that business and laid me on the table. And then they started asking, how did it happen? How do I know how it happened? Some guy shot me. Well, where did it go? I said, I have no idea. So they rolled me over and finally found there was a hole about the size of a little finger just above my hip. That was the entry.
And then
it came out by my navel. Uh-huh. And left about a 4x4 hole. And there it was. And
how many vital organs did that thing
hit?
Yeah,
I mean, it didn't hit anything. It didn't hit a thing.
Isn't that miraculous?
It is a miracle, yeah. I mean, and I remember one of the doctors who had been at Mayo Clinic, he said, O'Brien, you're in such good shape. The bullet took the course of least resistance. I'd give me a break, you know.
How long did it take you to recover before you went back?
I went back in the end of May, and the wounds happened on the 2nd or 3rd of February.
So that's 3 months.
But I was ambulatory.
Yeah.
I was walking.
During that time, were you ever scared or concerned that you weren't going to make it? Or that
I wasn't scared of that, but you know where proud flesh is?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, in the wound, right from the center of it, proud flesh started developing. And I was puffing up. I had the illusions. Maybe the shell is still in there, and it hasn't gone off yet.
That would get your attention, sure.
Yeah, and you know, and I kept watching this thing. And finally, a doctor came in. He was the guy from Mayo Clinic. He grabbed the pair of clippers and clipped off the proud flesh, and that was it. And never, it didn't hurt. And of course, it disappeared. It didn't come back.
What about your finger?
And the finger was, I guess I finally, you know, I could move it. And, of course, that gives you something else you can do. You can move the finger. And I don't have any stitches I had in there. But I remember when they cut it off, my first question was, this won't put me out of the Marine Corps, will it? The doctors assured me it wouldn't.
Well, you say that pretty matter of fact, but that's a big deal for someone really to come to grips with the fact that, hey, I had 10 and now I've got 9.
It sounds serious. And I guess it is serious, but you don't have to be morbid about it. It's there, and it's happened, and I'm still here to tell you that it happened.
And you wanted to get back with your fellow Marines.
They told us that this would be the last time you can go back and join your division. I think I was the last guy off the ship. They took me back to where L Company was. Prusik, the officer, came down, and he said, got a choice. You can either stay here in the re-echelon, or you can go with us on this one, and that'll be it. I said, fine, I'd rather go. You were glad to be back with the boys. You were glad to be there, and you were glad you were still alive.
Let me read something to you here, because it's signed by a guy you were just talking about, General Holland Smith, or as you all called him, Howlin' Mad Smith.
Yep.
It's a Bronze Star citation, and it says, for heroic achievement in action against the enemy while serving with the Marine Rifle Company on Saipan, Marianas Islands, from 15 June to 9 July 1944, when his squad leader was wounded early in the operation, Corporal O'Brien took over the squad and furnished his men with an excellent example of leadership. On 22 June 1944, Corporal O'Brien carried a wounded Marine on his back for some 200 yards under hostile machine gun and mortar fire when his platoon dropped back to a defensive line for the night. On 28 June 1944, he carried a wounded Marine from a position exposed to hostile machine gun and mortar fire some 200 yards to an area where he could be evacuated. His heroic actions were a source of inspiration to those about him and were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service.
And you know, and to be perfectly honest with you, you're scared and you want to get the hell out of there. And you'd pick up the Empire State Building and carry it if you had to.
But it says the rest of your guys in that first one on the 22nd, that the rest of your platoon had dropped back to a defensive line for the night, and you're running back out there where they're firing at you to try to rescue somebody.
Well, I mean, you know, and you don't know how you do it. You have no idea. And if you saw a movie of it, you wouldn't believe it. But you're scared. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's scared. I didn't see John Wayne out there at all. He can do all he wants in the movie, Wojima, but hey, baby, when you're there, you're scared. I guess I was scared. You know, you get done. And then the other thing that happens is that people observe you. Guys had to write down stuff. Whether they had illusions, I have no idea. But if it was machine gun fire or mortar fire, I don't remember that.
You just remember one of your buddies was down?
I just remember getting the hell out of there. And that was what I did.
After helping the Allies secure that victory in World War II, Francis O'Brien, minus that one finger, played tailback for Dartmouth. One of his memorable opponents was another World War II veteran by the name of Chuck Bednarik. Famous as the last two-way player in the NFL, Bednarik is in the College Football Hall of Fame and the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He survived 30 missions as a B-24 waste gunner in Europe during World War II. Francis O'Brien was thankful to survive colliding with Bednarik on the gridiron in the Dartmouth-Penn rivalry in the Ivy League.
We were playing Penn, and Penn had beaten us before the year before that, I mean, 39-2 or something, whatever it was. And incidentally, that year, I was 46. Bednarik, there were about three huge guys. Mm-hmm. He was one huge, and there were two others. And I had a bad back, but the coach still started me because I did pretty well the year before against Penn. And I had a tooth that was infected. And I used to take a needle and heat it up with a match and jam it in a hole in my tooth to break the pus pocket so it wouldn't ache. I remember... Here's this young bride I have, and I'm jamming this needle in my tooth. And then the time it got stuck, I had to get pliers to pull it out. Of course, we didn't have money for a dentist, so that's what I did.
Yeah.
But anyway, then we played Penn the following year, and it was nothing at the half. I remember it was like 3rd-and-1, and Sully called my play, an off-tackle play, and Bednarik met me in the hole. I made an inch or so, and he tried taking the football away. And I made the mistake of saying, get your hands off the ball. So he called the same play the next time, and he was right in the hole. And he hit me. And the mistake I should have said please instead of just saying get your
But so you felt the wrath of Chuck Bednarik on that fourth and short.
But the unfortunate part is, in those days, I don't know how it is today, you never met the guys you played against.
Right.
Because they got on a train, they went, or you got on a plane, they went. I told the story about Bednarik and my incident when we were coming back from overseas, my wife and I were taking a jitney from JFK down to Philadelphia. And the bus driver was talking to a friend of his that was with him, and he said, you know, about Bednarik, and my wife volunteered. My husband was tackled by Bednarik. So the guys run around, so let me shake the hand of a guy who's still living. After being hit by Bednarik. I only wish that we had had the chance to say, hey, geez, thanks a lot for smearing me or whatever else.
Francis O'Brien went on to a long career as a coach and educator and became the father of 14 children. We could go on and on, but we're out of time for this week. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find links to the complete original interviews with the three former college football players that you heard from today, as well as links to other World War II vets who played in college and have shared their stories here on the program. Here's to a great 2021 season. And no matter which school's colors you're wearing, let's all be reminded when we eye that red, white, and blue that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.